I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's March 28th, and we have a lot to talk about. One of the things that many people living with MS have problems talking about is their MS, disclosing their diagnosis to friends and family. Choosing when to disclose and to whom to disclose is a deeply personal decision. And joining me to talk about the risks and rewards of disclosing your MS diagnosis is Dr. Victoria Levitt. Dr. Levitt is a clinical neuropsychologist, researcher, and assistant professor of neuropsychology at Columbia University. And she's someone who's conducted several studies exploring how people with MS approach disclosure decisions. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Levitt, there are a few other things that you should know about. Research published early last year identified the Epstein-Barr virus, or EBV, as a trigger for MS. Many experts believe that eliminating the Epstein-Barr virus would eliminate most of the multiple sclerosis in the world. And since about 95% of the world's population carries the Epstein-Barr virus, eliminating it is no small task. A number of pharmaceutical companies are currently working on an Epstein-Barr virus vaccine, notably Moderna, a pharmaceutical company that leveraged its mRNA technology to produce an effective COVID-19 vaccine in record time, has been working on an EBV vaccine that would take advantage of that same mRNA technology. Now Merck, a global pharmaceutical company doing business in North America as EMD Serono, has announced a collaboration with ModeX Therapeutics to advance the development of MDX-2201, an investigational EBV vaccine. The two companies will continue the preclinical development of MDX-2201, and they will also file an investigational new drug application with the FDA, requesting approval to conduct clinical trials. This experimental EBV vaccine leverages nanoparticle technology to load four types of viral proteins into a single nanoparticle. As a quick refresher, a nanoparticle is so tiny that it's completely invisible to the human eye. By carrying four different viral proteins that are each important in allowing EBV to infect cells, the vaccine can trigger a powerful immune response to the Epstein-Barr virus. This multi-targeting approach has been developed by ModeX Therapeutics, and it's only possible because the vaccine is being delivered by nanoparticles. Producing an effective Epstein-Barr virus vaccine could be a significant step toward ending MS. We'll keep you posted as this work continues. When we talk about advocacy on this podcast, one of the fundamental issues that we always stress is ensuring access to MS prescription medications. In the United States, the FDA has approved more than 20 disease-modifying therapies, and access is determined by economics. What's the cost of a particular disease-modifying therapy? And will my private insurance or Medicare or Medicaid provide enough financial support for me to use any particular drug? In many low-income countries, access to MS medications is a far more fundamental question, with few DMTs approved for use at any price. To ensure worldwide access to MS treatments, the MS International Federation has petitioned the World Health Organization to include three disease-modifying therapies in its list of essential medicines. The WHO list of essential medicines often acts as a model for public health officials in a number of countries as they draw up the list of medications their country will supply to its citizens. The MS International Federation is requesting that Copaxone, Rituxan, and Mavenclad be added to that list. Now, in 2018, the MS International Federation requested that Copaxone, Gilenya, and Ocrevus be added to the WHO list of essential medicines, and their request was rejected on the grounds that there was no clear evidence provided that these three DMTs were superior to other MS medications in terms of efficacy, safety, and affordability. The WHO's Expert Committee on Selection and Use of Essential Medicines also pointed out that the MS International Federation's application failed to take into account off-label and commonly used medications. Over an 18-month decision-making process, the MS International Federation collaborated with a global nonprofit organization whose focus is on helping others make well-informed decisions about health issues. They reviewed over 30 MS therapies, including off-label treatments, and convened an international advisory panel that included people living with MS. The panel utilized recommendations from two guidelines to select treatments based on several criteria, such as the trade-off between a treatment's benefits and harms, its cost and cost-effectiveness in low-income and middle-income countries, the availability of generics or biosimilars, and other factors. They also considered whether the treatments addressed the needs of children and adolescents, pregnant women, and lactating women. The MS International Federation's revised application will be considered when the WHO Expert Committee meets during the week of April 24th, and we can expect a decision in the weeks following that meeting. If you'd like to review the editorial that appears in this month's issue of Lancet Neurology in support of the MS International Federation's application to the WHO, you'll find that link in today's show notes. By its very nature, scientific exploration often fails. And scientists understand that there's still much to be gained, much to be learned, even when you fail to reach the specific finish line you may have been hoping to cross. This is a story about just that sort of situation. Now, studies have shown that in any six-month period, more than 50% of the people living with MS fall at least once, and more than 30% fall multiple times. And falling is dangerous. It can cause broken bones, brain damage, and even death. It's also been shown that people with MS who are full-time wheelchair or scooter users fall frequently. But there isn't much in the way of fall prevention programs for these folks. So a research team created a six-week online fall prevention program designed specifically for people with MS who used a wheelchair or scooter full-time, and then the team analyzed the outcome. And at the end of all the testing and evaluations, it seemed that the fall prevention program did not have a statistical impact in fall incidents among the study participants. And so the study failed to meet its primary endpoint. But I don't know if you'd categorize this to be a failure, because what this online program did accomplish was it significantly reduced the study participants' fear of falling. It increased their knowledge of the kinds of things around their house that increased their risk of falling. And it increased their knowledge of what to do when they did fall. In other words, they learned the safest way to fall, or I guess I should say they learned how to land safely. So at the end of the day, these study participants still fell. But they spent less time being afraid, which translates to spending more time feeling empowered. And I imagine that sense of empowerment, that sense of being more in control, might have come from their increased knowledge of what kinds of things in their environment created a greater risk of falling, and their knowledge of what to do to prevent serious injury when and if they did fall. Like so many things in life, arming themselves with knowledge served to significantly reduce their fear. So while this particular study failed to meet its primary endpoint, it certainly provided evidence in support of something most of us know to be true. Knowledge is power. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Recently, I heard an MS specialist say, "When I'm examining an older patient and I notice that they're walking more slowly, I can't tell if they're walking more slowly because of MS or simply because they're aging." It's a perfect example of one of the many things we don't know about aging and MS. There aren't many studies of people living with MS who are over the age of 50, but as the MS population continues to age, we're beginning to see that change. As people age, they tend to use medical services more often. This is generally true for everyone, whether they happen to be living with MS or not. But a research team wanted to look at whether older people who were living with MS were using those healthcare services more frequently because they were older or because they had MS. So they analyzed just over 10,000 health insurance claims gathered over a period of 4 years from people over the age of 50 who were living with MS, and compared them with the same number of health insurance claims gathered over the same 4 years from people over the age of 50 who weren't living with MS. They found that cancer malignancies were about the same for both groups. But as you might expect, they found that the time to someone needing to use a cane, walker, or wheelchair was considerably shorter among the people living with MS. They found that the people living with MS had significantly more MRI exams than the people who didn't have MS. The people living with MS used skilled nursing facilities more than the people who didn't have MS. And people living with MS experienced a higher number of infections, with urinary tract, upper respiratory tract, and shingles among the most common types of infection. The research team concluded that among people 50 years and older, healthcare typically associated with worse health primarily resulted from having MS, rather than being a consequence of aging alone. Aging with MS is a rapidly growing area of interest among researchers, and we can expect to learn much more about this particular population in the months and years to come. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. I often say that MS doesn't just impact individuals, it impacts families. And my unscientific observation has led me to hypothesize that MS impacts different members of a family differently. So I was particularly interested in the recently published results of a study that looked at the psychosocial impact of MS on children and adolescents who had a parent living with MS. Now, this study was a systematic review. That is, it summarized other studies that had already been published. The research team screened 608 different references in the scientific literature. They assessed 72 different studies and included 28 of those studies in their review. Now, one of the challenges the research team noted was the differing nature of these studies and, in some cases, the quality of some of the studies, which made it difficult to draw conclusions or make comparisons. However, they did point out that most study results suggested negative consequences for children or adolescents who had a parent living with MS. Specifically, mood, behavior, or social interaction were negatively impacted. Several of the studies described associations between children who had a parent with MS and an increased incidence of psychiatric disorders, while other studies claim that children with a parent with MS were not more likely to have psychosocial problems compared to children without a parent with MS. A few studies even indicated probable positive effects of parental MS, such as potentially increased social competence among the children. The only conclusion the researchers were able to make was that having a parent with MS had a quote-unquote relevant effect on children, and further research was required to provide more robust evidence. When I thought about the mixed results of this study, I wondered whether the effect of having a parent with MS might be a function of a family's interpersonal dynamic, whether parenting styles or parenting skills might be the real indicators of whether a child is going to develop positive or negative psychosocial issues. Well, we'll have to wait for more research to be done here, but at the very least, these study results underscore that MS finds ways to impact everyone in the family, so building resilience becomes everyone's job. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. One of the things that every parent with MS does think about is when and how much to disclose about their MS to their children. And it's not only the children that they're thinking about. When you disclose your MS to your friends, your extended family, to someone you're dating, what are the potential risks associated with disclosing your MS diagnosis, and what are the potential rewards? Joining me in a moment to tackle some of these difficult but universal questions is neuropsychologist and neuroscientist Dr. Victoria Levitt. To tell or not to tell? For many people with MS, that is the question. Disclosing that you've been diagnosed with MS is a deeply personal decision that can cause considerable stress and anxiety. Joining me to take on this complex question is Dr. Victoria Levitt, a clinical neuropsychologist, researcher, and assistant professor of neuropsychology at Columbia University. Dr. Levitt has conducted several studies exploring how people with MS approach disclosure decisions. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Levitt.
Thank you, John. It's great to be here with you.
Let's start by talking about the research I just mentioned. Can you tell us what the purpose of these studies was, who was involved, and I guess most importantly, what you discovered?
Sure, absolutely. And to start my story, I have to go back to years ago when I had the pleasure of meeting a gentleman named Ken Bandler. He is somebody living with MS who was keeping it carefully hidden for over a decade. He was in a very prominent position at a New York agency, and he was keeping it hidden from his professional colleagues, from his close friends, from his family members. Even an aunt who herself had MS didn't know that he had MS. And the reason I'm telling you about him and I'm using his real name is that he finally told his story to a journalist from the Wall Street Journal. And so he went bold and he went big, but he became a poster child for disclosure. And when he told his story, he had a little anecdote that really stuck with me, which was that he used to sit at his desk and wonder if he could get across the office for a cup of coffee without stumbling or tripping. And I found myself thinking, as a cognitive neuroscientist, we need all the brain that we've got for all the tasks that we engage in. And I found myself thinking, if a person is making iterative decisions about whether or not to get a cup of coffee, what's the consequence of that? And so I went down this line of research trying to understand, what is this burden? What kind of a burden is imposed by these issues of disclosure and concealment, when or whether to disclose, and what would be the consequences? And so that was the starting point. And we developed a survey. We call it the DISCO, Disclosure and Concealment. We deployed it to, in our first study, 100 people, in our second, another 100 people, finally, most recently, to over 400 people in 18 different countries, but predominantly the United States. What we found is that again and again, we seem to see that about half of people with MS are actively concealing their diagnosis, and that about a third are concerned that there will be negative consequences, either personally or professionally. And so this has been very, very interesting for us to really understand. Most recently, we did a study in collaboration with Andy Salomon at the University of Vermont. Andy's very interested in the diagnosis experience. And what we did was we gave people a survey about their diagnosis experience. We found that people who felt that they had been given enough time with their practitioner during that initial diagnosis were less likely to conceal down the line and less likely to anticipate negative consequences. So by linking up these sorts of findings, we start to see a picture emerge where from the very moment a patient is diagnosed with MS, they might be on a trajectory for later behaviors with implications for their health and their brain health.
A couple of things come to mind. First, what a small world it is. I know Ken Bandler. So we've both met Ken Bandler. The latest study that you did where it went to different countries, I am curious, were you able to tease out cultural differences when it comes to the topic of disclosure?
Everybody wants to know that. And that's a good question. And that's an important question. And we are not there yet because what I may or may not have mentioned is that they were overwhelmingly from the United States. So we simply didn't have enough power to look at those differences. But that's a next level fascinating question. What sorts of cultural differences are at play in whether or not somebody shares their disclosure? Oh, and by the way, John, the fact that you know Ken Bandler, I think speaks to some of the upside of disclosing. It's because Ken Bandler shared his story in such a brave fashion on such a large stage that he's now part of this warm and wonderful and loving community of MS people. And we both know him.
I'm going to circle back to that concept in a moment. I did want to ask you about the roughly one third of your study participants who indicated that telling people about their MS would bring about negative consequences. What types of consequences are people most afraid of?
Gosh, there's so many. I think that underscores a key point that I've come to understand by researching this is that this issue permeates all aspects of one's life. So in professional and personal circles, there are different decisions to be made with different potential ramifications. Some people are worried about disclosing in the workplace. Some people are worried that it will make people evaluate them differently. Some people don't want to be pitied. Other people have more practical concerns, like will my job security be at risk? From a personal standpoint, people are worried about the reaction that their personal friends and loved ones may have. A lot of us want to protect our loved ones from the pain that we go through, and so that can be a reason to hesitate to disclose. And then there's all kinds of family dynamics we can't even begin to touch upon, right? With regards to whether to tell Aunt Sally and Uncle Jim and right.
The people you choose to disclose your MS to will each have their own coping mechanisms for processing that news. Some are going to respond exactly as you imagine they would. Others may not show any outward reaction at all. Others may burst into tears. Others may have a dozen questions for you. When all of that happens, when it happens in a way that maybe you hadn't expected, does it mean that you've gone about disclosure the wrong way?
Well, that's a little victim blaming now, isn't it, John?
Absolutely.
I think you're pointing out the weirdness of human beings, how we are all flawed, deeply flawed, and wonderfully beautiful in so many ways. And I have definitely learned by listening to my patients talk about their disclosure experiences that none of us is ever prepared for the types of reactions we're going to get from those around us. Indeed, some people do burst into tears, and then all of a sudden the person living with MS is the tables have turned and they're consoling the person they've just disclosed to, which, doesn't seem altogether fair, but it does indeed happen. I think another heartbreaking thing that sometimes happens is a person musters the courage to tell someone, and it's a big deal. And that someone never talks about it again, crickets. And it can be really painful, really hurtful, and leave the person feeling more alone than if they hadn't shared. And I think that that points to the fact that none of us is equipped to deal with this or really many of the types of things that are a part of the human experience. We're just not equipped. And so that's something that people need to think about, right? What's the reaction going to be? And they may have to manage that a little bit. They may have to be the ones. And it's again, why should it come back to the burden being on the person with MS? But it will, and it does. They might have to say to that friend, I shared that with you and it was really hard for me. I need you to ask me how I'm doing. I really do. I want to invite you to ask me how I'm doing from time to time. Whatever it is, whatever parameters you want, you put it in place. You control that. That's your information and you take control of it.
Well, as Ken Bandler pointed out, keeping your MS a secret can take a real toll on a person. So you've already started answering this question. I said I'd circle back to it. I hope you can talk about the upside of disclosure and how it can actually help someone feel better.
Thanks, John. That is a nice side of the coin that I like to talk about. I will say this gets like a little nerdy researcher, but when we first tried to publish this in the literature, we got blowback from reviewers who said, "There's already a bunch of papers on stigma. We already know this." Well, by the way, stigma means a mark of disgrace. That's only one side of the story. Indeed, we have looked at stigma as it relates to disclosure. We also wanted to look at the other side of the coin, which is what is the upside? And so we did ask people to tell us whether and how it had allowed them access to a community of support that they didn't have before. And that is something that people endorse as being accurate. Also, just anecdotally, in talking to patients, I've asked patients again and again whether they regret sharing. And no patient has ever told me, "I wish I could walk it back. I wish I could take it back. I wish I hadn't shared." It can be nuanced. It can be, "Well, I didn't expect this or that." But ultimately, I think that relief from the burden of secrecy always outweighs any downside to disclosing.
I've talked with parents who are living with MS, and I've heard from several of them that one of the things they tend to wonder about, worry about, certainly think about is when to disclose and how to disclose MS to their children. Are there any guidelines there?
That's a tricky one. And you bring to mind one patient of mine who had been keeping it from her grown children for over a decade. And she said, "I can't get over the idea that once I tell them, their whole lives will be defined as before they knew and after they knew." And that just broke my heart to think that she was carrying that burden with her. There's no one way to do it. There's no one right answer to this. The one thing I will say, as a parent myself, I think that kids know a lot more than we think. They feel things. They know something's up. And I think that their minds can go in scarier directions. Things can become bigger and worse. And that when we open up and tell them, we actually help them. We can alleviate a lot of the fear. Now, I also had another patient who told me about her daughter and how she was very nervous about what was going on with mom. And I invited that patient to bring her daughter with her to her next appointment. I said, "Bring her in here, bring her right inside, let her sit next to you. I'll talk her. She'll meet me. She'll see what this part of your world is about. And I think she'll see that it's not all that scary, right?" And I think that would go a long way towards helping.
A parent may want to disclose their MS to their children, but they may not want to disclose it to anyone outside of their family. What's the best way for them to help their children understand that they need to keep that information inside the house?
That's especially tricky. And I think a lot of that, the answer to that relates to the child's developmental stage, right, of understanding and conveying this message that certain things are just for us for in the family versus other things can be shared outside the family. I think it's important to send that message in a healthy way, because I also have another patient whose family was very, very, very secretive. And that's caused a lot of pain for this person as an adult to look back and realize that everything about her childhood was centered around this secrecy and a lot of shame in her family. So openness and sharing, but also in a loving way, allowing your children to know that this is something that's for us and it's not for everyone outside the family.
I want to ask you about disclosing in two other situations. The first one is dating. How and when do you tell the person you're dating about your MS?
That's just the impossible question to answer. It's a question that I've put back on groups of people with MS that I've put together just specifically to talk about this topic, because it would be nice if I had a set of guidelines or a pamphlet, but I don't. And I actively steer away from dispensing advice. I think these are personal choices. Deciding when and how to tell somebody when you're dating, it's kind of like if I were to answer the question, when and how do you tell somebody that you're dating that you love them? There's no answer to that. It has to do with trust. It has to do with mutual respect. And it also has to do with going back to what we were talking about before, which is knowing that that person may or may not respond the way you think they will, and being open to that. and finding forgiveness in our hearts for the imperfections of all of us.
Well, the other situation I wanted to ask you about was social media. Social media is a platform where people share information. They often overshare information. It can quickly become the land of TMI. What should someone consider before they disclose their MS in a social media post?
Consider that once it's out there, it's never coming back in, and that you have no idea where it's going to go. Social media is incredibly powerful and incredibly dangerous. So I think we all need to respect that and know that. And I think clearly there are lots of great opportunities to be had and to be facilitated by social media, right? The MS Society has a huge presence, and wanting to jump in and say, hooray, I'm with the MS community is great, but there can be consequences. So that's definitely an important choice to think through before you go big.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think sometimes we lose track of who might read that post, and it's not simply other people. For instance, you may be okay talking about your MS with your friends, and so you think you want to talk about it in social media, but you know you haven't disclosed it to your employer yet. But mm-hmm. somebody at work reads that post, and you've just disclosed it to your employer.
Yep, exactly. A good example, a good salient example, John.
Speaking of that, I one more situation to ask you about. Telling people at work about an MS diagnosis may be one of the most complex disclosure decisions someone makes. What are some things people should consider when it comes to disclosing MS in the workplace?
I guess I always handle this question delicately because we all know that there are laws and legal protections, and then we know that there are realities of situations. So I had a patient who was dismissed from the workplace from a job that she loved because she made a request for an accommodation and she disclosed. And she very clearly, in no uncertain terms, had a lawsuit, but that's not the direction she went in. She just went out and found a new job the very next day because she wanted to do what she loved and she didn't want to get bogged down by something horrible. And that's not right. And that's not fair. That's heartbreaking that that happened to her. But this is the world we live in. And so these are the realities that we do have to consider.
Well, Dr. Victoria Levitt, it's always a treat having you on the podcast. Thank you for all you do to improve the lives of people affected by MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you so much, John. It's great to see you and great to speak with you again.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society, and you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/291. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.